Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Yusuf Mullah here. So welcome everyone to the second presentation in this free series of videos. Inshallah, in this presentation, towards the end of it, I'm going to explain to you the four stages of growth that you need to get through in order to successfully reach your goal in understanding the Quran and being able to appreciate its miracle. And we'll tell you their names. What are those four stages? The startup phase, the initial growth, rapid growth, followed by continuous growth. And we'll tell you what kind of behavior is required from you in order to successfully move from one stage to the next. Okay, but before that, we're going to quickly recap what was covered in the previous video and then teach you some actual content. I'm going to go through the parts of speech. Okay, in Arabic, the parts of speech, I'm going to develop the word, the sentence, and the phrase. And we're going to leave some of it for the third and the fourth video. So again, I would suggest that you don't take furious notes. There's really no need for that because all of the content is being provided to you in numerous formats. Okay, the whole point of giving it to you in videos is so that you can download the video eventually. After you've watched it once, then the download link should appear underneath this video once you come back to the page, and then you can watch it more than once. And this is how learning happens. This is how I do it. Okay, because this is all core theory. And this is by far the most important aspects of the language that you need to know in order to begin any reading, right? So it's worth listening to and watching more than once. Okay, so with that said, you don't have to take any notes, and there's also the transcripts, and there's also the 45-page report. So when you combine all of these resources, you will know it very well. Okay, and this kind of material is the type of material you need to actually overlearn. So there is going to be some overlap between what we're presenting today and what's in the document, and I've thought about this. Okay, there might be some people that don't like overlap, but I think the vast majority of people really appreciate it when the same concept is introduced more than once in different styles and different ways using different analogies. Then this really helps to solidify, and it helps to get you to a level where you're at unconscious competence, because they say there's four stages of learning. The first is unconscious incompetence, okay, and this is where you don't even know what you don't know. And the second, and I'll give you examples for this. The second stage of learning is when you're consciously incompetent. Okay, and now you know that you don't know. Okay, the third stage is when you're consciously competent, and the final stage is unconsciously competent. Okay, the example is that when you're learning to drive, okay, before you ever learned to drive, before you ever took a lesson with an instructor, you had no idea what the clutch was, and you had no idea that you have to put it in gear, and this is how you park, and this is how you signal, and this is how you turn. So you didn't even know those things were necessary. So that was unconscious incompetence. And then once you started taking lessons, at that point, you were taught all of these things, these elements that are required in order to drive properly. Okay, and then eventually when you got your license and you drove for some time, then you became consciously competent. At first you were consciously competent, and then eventually unconsciously competent, that you drive and you can do many other things and still drive and not have any problem with that. But the same people that are unconsciously competent when it comes to driving, when they're parallel parking, then they have to turn the radio off, and they have to tell the kids to be quiet, and they have to, if their friend is speaking to them, be quiet. Okay, I need to concentrate, because they haven't reached that level of unconscious competence when it comes to parallel parking. Okay, so if you want to read books in Arabic, like the tafsir of Imam Al-Alusi, or one of the books by Imam Ibn Taymiyyah or Imam Al-Ghazali, and you want to lie on your bed and be able to read 100 pages without being overwhelmed at all, then you have to reach this level of unconscious competence. Okay, and the vowels are not written in the books. Okay, we mentioned in the previous video that the majority of meanings in Arabic do not come from words, but instead they come from vowels. But yet, when you open up the books, the vowels aren't there. So how does that make any sense? Right? So this is, you need to get to that level. And the other example I'd like to give is of typing, that most people have reached a level of unconscious competence when it comes to typing. So they can type very quickly without ever having to look at the keyboard, and with making very few mistakes. So this is what we want for you when it comes to the study of Arabic, that you can read the books by the scholars and be reasonably confident that you're not making a mistake, and you can do it quickly, and you can read as easily as you read books in English. So let's quickly recap the big mistake. Okay, when most people approach the study of Arabic, they start with simple structures and they gradually try to reach the advanced. And what they're doing really is they're taking a sophisticated and complex system and breaking it up into small little portions and trying to tackle each one with slight improvements in every area. And this will never work. This is not how it's done. It's like within the Arabic language, there is an inherent simplicity. And what we need to do is we need to identify that and learn that first. Okay, and what it is theory. It's basically the mechanism of how the meanings are conveyed. And I'm not talking about the vocabulary, I'm talking about the non-word meanings. Because what looks like a single word in Arabic can often convey seven meanings. And this was presented to you in the previous video. So when you understand the non-word meanings, the overall framework of how the language works, then at that point, you have the inherent simplicity. Like, it's not very complicated. Okay, it could be done in the span of a few short days. And this is what we're doing in this free series of videos. So the simple to the complex approach is the big mistake, and this is what causes the majority of frustration. This is why people abandon textbooks and move to another series of textbooks, and when they move from teacher to teacher, and they gain no traction and no blessings. Our approach to studying Arabic, it starts with the big picture first. Okay, the human emotions and the facial expressions analogy, which I'll give to you later in this video. And then once we and the big picture really, it's really the 4% of the language. That gives you over half of all of your benefits presented as a big picture. And it focuses on the aspects that have the most broadest application, the fundamentals of the language that you would expect to encounter in practically every sentence. And 80-20 is prevalent throughout in all facets of life. It's in nature and it's also in human behavior and it's in everywhere you look. Okay, they say 20% of people account for 80% of crime. Okay, 20% of people are holding 80% of wealth. 20% of you name it will be responsible for 80% of whatever the causes that it produces. And the Arabic language is no different. Within the Arabic language, there is a small amount of rules that if you know them, you'll get 80% of all of your benefits. And then when you go more dense into this 20, there's an even denser inner core, which is what we're teaching right now. The 4% of the language that gives you over half of all of your benefits. Why do we do all of this? We do this with one purpose in mind, and that is that we can start a reading text as soon as possible. Okay, and this is extremely important because the minute the book begins, several things happen. First of all of the grammar comes to life. So the theory you're learning it with the purpose of implementing it as soon as possible. And this is like within days, you're reading an actual book in Arabic, and then every word, every sentence, and every phrase in that book becomes an example of what was taught earlier. So when you see the repeated application of it, then your initial understanding of the theory gets stronger and stronger. Okay, because with every subsequent application of the principle, your understanding of it cannot decrease. It can only get more clear and it can only increase. And the enthusiasm level of the student goes through the roof. Okay, because you're getting the payoff straight away. You don't have to wait for the payoff. And this is what we do. So in the first few days, we're giving the big picture of how the language works, immediately with the intention of following up with the reading text. The minute the book begins, the enthusiasm level of the student goes through the roof, and all of that theory that was taught earlier now comes to life with real examples from the Quran. Okay, so there's two sciences that we start with, and the third science we introduce a little later. And those two sciences are sarf and nahw. Sarf means morphology and nahw means grammar. Sarf is to do with the patterns. Okay, so the example that was given in the previous video was a verb, and there was letters in there. There were three base letters, and we were getting a meaning from the three letters. And then there was more meaning coming from the pattern, which involved the two letters at the front, and also the waw at the end, and also the particular vowel in configuration. So this is all studied in a science called sarf. Okay, so sarf is the science of classical Arabic that deals with patterns of vowelization and non-base letters that convey tense, voice, and added connotations. So in one sentence, this is exactly what we were highlighting in that example. Okay, so there was one meaning that was coming from the actual consonants, and you get that from the dictionary. The other six meanings do not come from the dictionary, they come from knowing sarf. So now, obviously, you can see how important this is. You see, it makes up 30% of total comprehension. And this is the science that the scholars have always attached importance to. It comes in the biography of Imam Nawawi, who was one of the greatest scholars of this ummah, that he used to split up his day into 12 portions, and he used to spend time studying 12 different sciences with his various teachers, and amongst those sciences was Sahih Muslim. And amongst those sciences was Al-Muhazzab, which is a book in Shafi'i Fiqh. And he was studying tafsir, and he was studying hadith, and it comes with darsan fi tasrif. And one of his 12 sciences that he was studying was the science of Arabic morphology, which is the same science that we highlighted to you in the previous video, explained in the report. And our third presentation is going to be pure sarf. Okay, verb patterns explained, that's the name of the presentation. And inshallah, I think you're going to really enjoy that. It's a 30-minute video, and we'll unlock it for you as soon as tomorrow, provided that you finish watching this one. Okay, and sarf also speaks about the designating endings, the designated letters that are appended to the end of the verb. And the purpose of that letter at the end of the verb is to give you the gender, the plurality, and the person of the one doing the verb. So you know that the one doing the verb is a male or a female, and you know that the one doing the verb is one or more than one, or are you talking to them, are you talking about them, or are you yourself the one doing the verb? So that all comes from the end. So depending on what letter you put at the end of the verb, you'll know the one doing the verb, basically. So in the Istansaru example, it was the wow. Okay, that wow was giving us three things. It was telling us that this is a group. It was also telling us that this is a group of males, and also that we're talking about them. And it's not you, group of males, but instead it's they, group of males. So all of that was coming from the letter. So apart from the wow, there's other letters that could be appended to the end of istansara. Like if I put a noon at the end and I say istansarna, that it means they, group of females, sought help. And if I put another letter, it could mean I sought help. Okay, now the purpose here is not to tell you the total or what are they. That will be then, inshallah, in the next presentation, in the third one. We'll give you the actual total and we'll fill the slots for that particular verb, the past tense verb, right? Okay, but sarf is the science that deals with this. So two things, patterns and endings. Okay, so just remember that patterns and endings. So everything to do with patterns, everything to do with endings, and when I say endings, I'm talking about verbs specifically. The last letter that comes at the end of the verb, the purpose of that is to give the gender, the plurality, and the person of the one doing the verb. So sarf is the science that talks about all of that. And then grammar is when you take the words and combine them together. Because when people speak, they don't speak in verbs. It's not all you do. There's other elements that are required in order to speak. Because when people speak, they don't speak in single words. They speak in sentences. And sentences are made up of words and phrases. So how to connect the words together to make meaningful sentences? What are the sanctioned methods of connecting words together? Okay, and you get more than what you started off with, which is the whole purpose. Remember, in the previous video, we said the majority of meanings in Arabic do not come from words. I'll repeat that one more time. The majority of meanings in Arabic do not come from words. They come from vowels, they come from patterns, and they come from grammatical structures. So patterns is discussed in sarf. Vowels, when I say vowels, I'm talking about single vowels. Single vowels, and just keep that at the back of your mind. We're going to return back to it later. Single vowels. So, just by the change of one single vowel, you'll introduce more meaning. Okay, and this is grammar. This is the subject matter of grammar. Grammar will tell you what kind of change, single vowel change, can result in what kind of meaning. Okay, so it's all about words, sentences, and phrases. And here's the definition of grammar, a working definition. The more precise definition, you'd need more for that. And we'd give that to you at a later stage. So grammar is the science of classical Arabic that teaches you how to arrange words to make meaningful sentences in ways that are sanctioned by the language. So sometimes when you take two words together and connect them, the result is a phrase. And sometimes when you take two words and connect them together, the result is a full sentence. You see? So words, sentences, and phrases is the subject matter of grammar. And to give you a better understanding of this, let's go ahead and map the language for you. So we'll start with the most basic, and we'll end up with the three things that I just listed for you, words, sentences, and phrases, and we'll do this on the next slide. So the most basic sound that comes out of the human mouth is called lafz. And in English we call it an utterance. And this is regardless of whether it's even meaningful or meaningless, it doesn't matter. Like any sound, like a random noise, like just IU or just something that a person speaks. Or you could say like the word Pepsi, for example, that's the name of a beverage. Before the advent of this now famous beverage, if anyone spoke that word Pepsi, it would have been meaningless. But it's still a love because it's spoken. So anything that comes out of the human mouth is called a love. And if it's meaningful, then this is called Maudur. Maudur means coined. In other words, it underwent a process where the earliest natives of that language took that particular sound or syllable configuration and assigned it a meaning. So they said this particular object, whenever we want to refer to it, we'll call it a tree. So the word tree is an example of Maudur. Okay, and then we have muhmal on the other side. And muhmal, meaningless, obviously we're not going to talk about it. We're just listing it for classification purposes. All of our focus is on the right side of the diagram. And mawdu would either be one word, single, which is known as a kalima, or it's going to be more than one, which is compound. And again, compound is two or more words, not like a grocery list. I mean, like, you don't take two or more words and just line them up side by side. They have to be arranged in a way that's sanctioned by the language. And then this could result in a full sentence, or it could result in less than a sentence. Okay, if it's a full sentence, we call that a jumla. And if it's less than a sentence, then that's a phrase. So the murakkab could be mufid or it could be ghair mufid. Mufid means beneficial. And ghair mufid means it's non-beneficial. Okay, now obviously non-beneficial here doesn't mean that it's meaningless, because we've already talked about that, and that's the one at the top. And we mean two or more words connected together that do not convey a particular benefit. So there is some benefit. Obviously the words mean something, and the arrangement has its own benefit, but it's lacking a particular benefit. So there's a benefit that's affirmed in the sentence, and that same benefit is negated from the phrase. So what is that? So let me go ahead and tell you. Okay, if the two or more words are connected together in a manner that conveys to the audience a benefit upon which silence is appropriate, then that's a sentence. And if it's not conveying a benefit upon which silence is appropriate, then that would be غير مفيد, what in English we call a phrase. So after doing all of this, we end up with three things. We have the word, the sentence, and the phrase. And this is all of grammar, because when people speak, they speak in sentences, and sentences are made up of words and phrases. So if you know everything there is to know about the word, and you know everything there is to know about the sentence, and you know everything there is to know about the phrase, then pretty much that's all of grammar. So in this presentation, we're going to develop for you the word. And inshallah, in video 3, we'll speak specifically about the verb, and that will be more of a surf presentation, and then we'll get back to grammar. And in the fourth presentation, we're going to give you a lot about how the nouns are used, the multiple ways a noun could be used in a sentence. And all of these topics that are being taught here are also in the 45-page document. So I would strongly suggest that you print that out and read that document, and don't worry about the overlap. Because what you want here is you want to reach the level of unconscious competence, and in order to do that, you have to overlearn. Okay, so I just said that one more time, and let's continue forward now with developing the word. So this is parts of speech. Now, in English, when we say parts of speech, we're talking about nouns and verbs and pronouns and adverbs. Okay, so most people are familiar with those terms. Like, what is a noun? What is a pronoun? What is an adjective? What is an adverb? And I'll also remind you of what they are here, in case you don't remember or you need your memory refreshed. So that's not a problem. Okay, now we have three parts of speech in Arabic. So I can go ahead and list for you the three parts of speech. What are their names? And I can go ahead and define them with some examples. That would be an inferior approach. I mean, you're very likely to forget it if I do it in that way. So what I'll do is I'll tell you what they are, but I won't define them. Not now, not yet. But instead, I'll spend time on the English parts of speech. Okay, and there are more. There are like 8 or 9 in English, as opposed to the 3 we have in Arabic. And I'll take those 9, and I'll assign them to the ones we have in Arabic. And this will give you a very clear understanding of what the parts of speech are, in a way that you'll never forget them. And then after I've done all of that, then I'll go ahead and define them one by one. So let's proceed with this. Okay, here are their names in Arabic. And if you've studied grammar in the past, then you will be familiar with these three terms. One of them is called ism. Okay, the other one's fi'al. And the third one's harf. And I won't even tell you what they are. Let's proceed now with the English parts of speech. And we'll return back to these in a minute. Okay, so in English we have the noun. And the noun is an entity, or like a place, person, or a thing. And then we have pronouns, which are smaller words, which are used to refer to nouns when the nouns have already been mentioned. So you say Zaid came in the house, and then he went to the kitchen, and then he turned on the sink, and then he poured a glass of water, and then he. So you would say Zaid once, but after every subsequent reference to the person would not be through the name, but instead the pronoun would be used. And then there's third person pronouns, there's first person pronouns, he, they, she, you, I, we, many types of pronouns. And then the third part of speech in English is an adjective. And an adjective is a word that's used to modify a noun. So like the word small, or the word big, or the word lazy, or the word happy. So they modify the noun. So when you say man, it's applicable on billions of people. Every man would be included when you say the word man. But when you say tall man, then you've removed a certain percentage of men that are below a height that you've determined to be above average. So anything above average would be tall. So you reduce the number by half. So this is what we mean by modifying. So every adjective, it modifies a noun. Okay, and then we have adverb, which is the part of speech in English that modifies other than noun. Okay, so like a verb, for example. So we have quick, we have came, and we have came quickly. So the word quickly would be an adverb. Or it can modify another adjective. Like, for example, a person is tall, a person is very tall. So the word very is an adverb because it's modifying tall. Because even within tall, we have various degrees. So if you want to pinpoint and narrow it down further, you would be using an adverb. So the first modification happens with the adjective, and the next modification happens with an adverb. So an adverb is a part of speech in English that modifies other than noun. And by other than noun, I mean both adjectives, okay, and verbs, and other adverbs, like came very quickly. So over there, quickly is modifying came, and very is modifying quickly. Okay, the fifth part of speech is verb, and verb is an action plus tense, past, present, and future. And then preposition, which is the small part of speech, in, on, to, from, are examples of prepositions. And they're generally brought in order to express meanings or express attributes of the upcoming word that otherwise cannot be understood. So you say, I traveled, and then you want to mention the origin of the travel. Okay, and then you want to mention the destination of the travel. So you can't say, I traveled Basra, Kufa. Because if you say, I traveled Basra, then that could mean you took a tour. And that's not the intended meaning. The intended meaning is the travel initiated from Basra, and the travel culminated on Kufa. So you would say, I traveled from Basra to Kufa. So from is a preposition, to is a preposition. Because what it did is it brought out a meaning of the upcoming word, an attribute of the upcoming word, in other words, to be an origin that would otherwise not be understood. And same thing with the Kufa, the T-O, to, it expressed that Kufa was the actual destination of the travel. So to be an origin, to be a destination are attributes, and these attributes would not have been understood if I did not use the prepositions from and the preposition to, and every preposition is like that, if you think about it. Okay? And then we have conjunctions. Conjunctions are, again, they're small words, generally just two or three letters, like and, andy, or the word or the word nor, or even the word but is a conjunction. The purpose of a conjunction is to allow abbreviation. So you want to say Zayd and Amr came. So you don't have to repeat yourself. You don't have to mention the verb twice. You can just mention the verb once and use the conjunction and to connect the two nouns together, because those two nouns are those two nouns are in the same role. Together they're forming the subject of the verb. So Zayd and Amr came. Or you can say Zayd came not Amr. So what you've done is you've affirmed the coming for Zayd and you've negated it from Amr with the not, without having to repeat the verb twice. So you see, a conjunction is a part of speech in English that allows abbreviation, so you don't have to repeat yourself more than once. Okay, and then finally we have the article, which is T-H-E, the, okay, definite article, or we have an indefinite article, a, and I think that's pretty self-explanatory. So we have these eight parts of speech in English. So now, in order to understand our three that we have in Arabic, what we're going to do is we're going to assign these. So the first four, the noun, the pronoun, the adjective, and the adverb, are what we call in Arabic ism. Okay, so ism is the part of speech that includes all four of these. So every place, person, thing, every pronoun, every word that modifies, describes, and quickly and swiftly, and words like that, they're all included within ism. And then we have verb, which corresponds 100% to what the English, our Arabic one is fi'l, and this corresponds 100% to what the English people call verb. And then we have the three smaller ones, the preposition, the conjunction, and the article, and they're all classified under the third category, which is harf. So now I think you have a 70-80% understanding of what these three are. And you see how helpful it was for me to do this, to take the eight English parts of speech and refresh your memory on them? Okay, it took me 5 minutes, but I think those 5 minutes were probably the best 5 minutes that I could have spent in this presentation in order to clarify for you exactly what the three parts of speech are in Arabic, instead of just starting directly with ism, fi'l, and harf. Okay, so now, once we have the three parts of speech, let's go ahead and give precise definitions. So, in order to do this, what you'll need to do is you'll have to look at the commonalities between between the eight that were assigned on the previous slide. So if you looked at the bottom three, the prepositions, the conjunctions, and the articles, and you try to look for a commonality between them, you'll notice that all of them express meanings in something else, as opposed to having a meaning in itself. Okay, and this is what characterizes a harf. Every harf has this. Okay, and I gave you an example of the from. Okay, because if they ask you what is the meaning of from, so you would say that from is a preposition that indicates an origin. So is it the from that's the origin? Or is it the upcoming word that's the origin? Obviously, it's the upcoming word. So from indicated on a meaning in something else. As opposed to if I say tree. Because if I say tree, I'm talking about the object itself that has the trunk and has the branches and the leaves. That is the tree. So it is the tree which is the tree. But it's not the from which is the origin. You see? Okay, so this is true for from. And I can give you a second example. And. And is a conjunction that indicates on gathering. So it is the is it the end that's gathered, or is it the words on the two sides of the end that are gathered together in a single ruling? So obviously it's the Zayd and the Amr together that are being gathered with the end. Zayd and Amr came. So this is a meaning in something else, right? And the indicates on specificity. A indicates on generality, and specificity is a meaning in something else. Generality is a meaning in something else. It's the upcoming word that's being specified. It's the upcoming word that's being generalized. Okay, so harf indicates on a meaning in something else. Okay, so that's the definition. Harf is the part of speech in Arabic that indicates on a meaning in something else. How easy is that? So once you've done that, then that means that the other two, the ism and fi'l, are parts of speech that indicate on a meaning in themselves. It's true for the ism, it's true for the fi'l, and then we'd have to look for a difference between them. So we'd say the fi'l has tense and the ism doesn't. So now we have all three definitions. So here's the definition of the verb. The fi'l is the part of speech in Arabic that indicates on a meaning in itself and is also linked to time. And ism is the part of speech in Arabic that indicates on a meaning in itself and is not linked to time. Okay, now what we do is we take all three of them, the ism, the fi'l, and the harf, and we subclassify them. And we take the ism, because the ism is very broad. It includes nouns, it includes pronouns, it includes adjectives, and it includes adverbs. And if you look at the reality of the noun and compare it to the reality of the adverb, then they're not the same. There's like big differences between a noun and an adverb, to the point that the English people chose to keep them separate. So in Arabic, they've been clumped together. So you've seen them together, so now it's only appropriate that you see them separate. So this would be done through subclassification process. And I'm going to leave that here. Okay, in our premium program, we do this quite a bit, and we give you additional vocabulary that will then be used when the reading book begins, so we can draw on the concepts. Okay, but for the sake of time, I'm going to leave this, and we're going to move to the fi'l. The fi'l is the verb. And in Arabic, there's only three kinds of verbs. There's the verb that indicates on the past tense that the action has already occurred. The example is kataba. Kataba means wrote, and this is called the madi verb. The next verb is the one that indicates on both the present and the future tense. And in Arabic, this is called the mudari', which we call the imperfect verb. So perfect, imperfect. Past tense verb, present, future tense verb. Perfect means the action's already occurred. Imperfect means that it's either ongoing or it's yet to begin. And mudari includes both. So we have a single word that could convey both meanings. And obviously the context would distinguish which one's which. Okay. And then the third kind of verb is the amr, which is the command verb. And the example of that is ishrab and drink. Now, if you look at the Arabic words kataba, that's the three consonants, nothing additional. It's just the three consonants, and each letter has a vowel, a fatha on it. And if you look at yansuru, it's a little larger. It has the three letters, the noon, the sad, and the ra, and it has a particular letter at the front, yan. And if you look at ishrab, it has a hamza at the front, and has a sukun at the end. So all of these things are relevant. It's the particular vowel configuration, and in the case of the middle verb, it's the added letter, the prefix, that distinguished it from the other one. Because like in a book, you wouldn't have any vowels. Remember I told you that in classical books, there's no vowels. So, but you have the letter, and the letter is actually represented with script. So kataba doesn't have a letter at the front. Yansuru has the ya at the front. So that's how you would know which one's which. Okay? And then there's other methods. It's like typing. Like I said, you have to reach that level of unconscious competence in order to properly be able to appreciate this. Okay, right now it might be a little fuzzy, like how are these things figured out? But at any rate, the purpose right here is to classify the verb into three categories. We have the perfect, the imperfect, and the command, the madi, the mudari, and the amr. And now let's move on to the harf. The harf, okay, it included those three categories, which we listed in English, the preposition, the conjunction, and the article. Okay, but that's not how it's classified in Arabic. But instead, in Arabic, we're going to classify it based on whether it induces change on the upcoming word or whether it doesn't. So we have the governing agent and we have the non-governing agent. So the big question at this stage is, what does it mean to govern and what does it mean to not govern? This is the mechanism, and this is probably the most important part of this presentation. And if you're over analytical, or if you tend to overanalyze, then I would suggest you to pay attention now, because this is the type of thing that you need to overanalyze, right? And all the previous stuff wasn't really, it was all leading up to this. So we have the harf, which is the governing agent and the non-governing agent. So what does it mean to govern? What does it mean to not govern? Okay, so let's go ahead. Okay, human beings experience emotional states. People make us happy, angry, sad, frustrated, embarrassed. And all of these emotions are then reflected on our face. So by looking at the human being's face, you can tell whether they're happy, or they're angry, or they're sad, or they're frustrated, or they're embarrassed. Why does that happen? It happens because of interaction. So Arabic words behave in a similar fashion. Okay, Arabic words behave in a similar fashion. Words influence words. So they interact with one another, and they cause the upcoming word to experience a grammatical state. So try to understand the analogy that human beings experience emotional states, and these emotional states are reflected on the face, and it's induced by the interaction. Similarly, Arabic words experience grammatical states, and these states are reflected on the last letter. So by the particular vowel on the last letter of the noun, you're able to tell what state it's experiencing, and it's the preceding word that causes that. So the preceding word induces the change on the upcoming word. So certain harfs do this and other harfs don't do this. So there's a harf that would induce a change on the upcoming word, and there's a harf that won't do that. And I'll give you a couple of examples on the next slide. Okay, now unlike human emotions, which are endless, grammatical states in Arabic are just three. There's only three states that an ism can experience. And those three states have names, and I'll give you a second analogy to make this very crystal clear. And the names of the three states are Rafa, Nasab, and Jar. So the ism can experience Rafa, Nasab, or Jar. And notice that I've lined them up with the three pronoun examples, he, him, and his. If you can understand the difference between he, him, and his, you have a 60-70% understanding of what Rafa, Nasab, and Jar are. Okay, so what is he, him, and his? This is the same meaning being conveyed in three different ways in English. So when you're referring to a male in the third person, you have a choice. You're going to use between either he, him, and his. But it's not really a choice, because you have to use the right one at the right time. So when the pronoun is intended to be the subject of a verb, you would say he came. And when the pronoun is intended to be object of the verb, you would say I saw him. And when the pronoun is intended to be used in a possessive structure, you would say his pen. Or you would say the pen is his. The pen is his in that format. So at any rate, So this in English only happens in pronouns. So like in a noun, if I was using a noun in different ways, I wouldn't change the noun. It would be the same noun. I would say the house fell. I entered the house. Door of the house. So house, house, house. But in Arabic, what would happen is the word house would actually change. And the change wouldn't be the whole word. It would only be the last letter. Okay? So like if I want to say the house fell, I would say saqat al-baytu. And if I want to say I entered the house, I would say dakhaltul bayta. So dakhaltu, I'd use a particular verb form that indicates on I. The conjugation that has the last letter, the tu at the end, that means I. And then the noun, house, would be listed third, and it would have a fatha on the last letter. So albaytu, albayta, and in the third example, babul bayti, door of the house, albayti. So the word is changing. In English, it's not changing. The house fell down, I entered the house, door of the house, 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 house. But notice in Arabic, we're saying saqat al-baytu, saqat dakhaltu al-bayta, and babul bayti. So these are the three states. And the vowel that's used to distinguish the states is a different vowel. So in Rafa, it's generally reflected by Dhamma. And Nasab is generally reflected with Fatha, and Jar is reflected with Kasra. So this is it. This is the process that's likened to human emotions and facial expressions. And this is based on need and necessity. And let me elaborate a little more on that, and then we're done with this presentation. Remember, in the previous video, we said that when you have a verb and two nouns, every language needs to be able to tackle this problem, that which of the nouns is the one doing the verb, and which of the nouns is the one upon whom the verb is being done. Some languages do it through extra words. Like in Urdu, if you want to say Zaid hit Amr, you would say Zaid ne Amr ko mara. So ne is a word, ko is a word. So the purpose of ne is to tell you which noun is the one doing the verb, and the purpose of ko is to tell you which noun is the one upon whom the verb is being done, and you'd have the verb at the end, mara. Mara means hit. Zaid ne Amr ko mara. You need 5 words to convey that meaning. In English, it's done by sequence. So the noun at the very front is automatically the subject, the verb will be in the middle, and the noun at the end would automatically be the object, and if you switch it around, the meaning changes. So you would say Zaid hit Amr, and if you say Amr hit Zaid, then it's not the same meaning anymore. In Arabic, the sequence is flexible. So the verb and the two nouns could be arranged in 6 different ways. And it would be the particular vowel at the end of the noun, which will tell you which noun is the one doing the verb. And it will be the particular vowel at the end of the second noun that will tell you that that second noun is the one doing is the object of the verb. And now it doesn't matter which one's first and which one's second. So we say, ضرب زيدون عمران. ضرب زيدون عمران. And if I say, ضرب زيدان عمرون, the meaning changes. And now, Amr could be at the very front. عمران ضرب زيدون. It was Amr that Zayd hit. And now you can arrange it in 6 different ways. More on this in the 4th presentation. And if you want more on it now, then you can go ahead and access the 45-page document, because I've elaborated on this in quite some depth. So that's pretty much what it means to govern and what it means to not govern. In the case of a harf, okay, I have 2 examples here. Ma nasara means did not help, and fil bayti means in the house. So ma is a harf and fi is a harf. If you look at ma nasara, take away the ma, it's nasara. He helped, put the ma, did not help. So the ma, obviously, it indicated on a meaning. In nasara, the fact that the action did not happen, so negation is the meaning that's coming from ma. And fi indicates on containment. So something is happening in the house. In the house. So something is happening in the house, so there's containment that's indicated by fi. But the point to illustrate here is that ma is not changing the way the upcoming word is looking. Because nasara was nasara prior to the entry of ma, and it's still nasara after the ma has entered, ma nasara. As opposed to fi, because if you take away the fi, then the last surah of al-bayt did not necessarily have to have a kasra. It could have been al-baytu if it was used in a structure that dictated that. And it could have been al-bayta if it was used in a structure that dictated that. So the ending on al-bayt is sort of flexible. It's like the human face that could be smiling or it could be frowning. That's the ending on bait, but that's not true for nasara, right? So ma did not induce any change on the upcoming word, so therefore it's a non-governing agent, whereas fi did induce change, so it is a governing agent. So basically that's it. So now, in order to properly progress through all of this, you're going to have to get through 4 stages. So let me quickly go ahead and tell you the 4 stages of growth. So we have the startup phase, and this is, it lasts for about 2.5 weeks, and within the startup phase, the aim and the goal is to teach the student how the language works. So basically they get an overall framework, and they get over half of all of their benefits right up front in the opening days of class. Okay, and then this then leads to the introduction of the book, the reading book. And once the reading book begins, then we're into initial growth, which is the second phase. So here, you're solidifying and reinforcing all the theory that was taught earlier. Not only that, but you're being taught new grammar based on need and necessity. So as the author of the book introduces newer structures, we're talking about them. And we're restricting ourselves to only those aspects that have the broadest application. So startup was focusing on the 4% of the language, and in initial growth, we're moving and broadening our scope to 20%. 20% of the language that gives you 80% of your benefits. And this lasts for about 5.5 months. So by the end of the 6th month, you're done with these 2 stages and you're moving into rapid growth. And rapid growth is the stage when you're studying a book unvoweled, without the vowels written in the book. Because what you need in a class is someone to force you to prepare the book, infer the vowels, because the vowels aren't there. So you're going to have to use all of the grammar that was taught to you earlier and infer and be able to read unvoweled text. Okay, and then you're into the continuous growth phase. And this is what Imam Nawawi, he's studying Sahih Muslim and Al-Muhazzab, and still he hasn't left his study of the Arabic language. Because Arabic is the first thing that the scholars study, and they continue studying it for the rest of their lives. So what happens in continuous growth is now you have a level of independence, and you're able to access the books by the scholars in grammar and also in balagha, because the books in balagha are large. There's a 550-page text in balagha, the commentary by Imam At-Taftazani. Okay, but let me tell you the good news, and the best news you'll ever get, and that is that in order to access books in tafsir, What you need is you need a very good, strong understanding in grammar. But you don't need to be a master in balagha. So you don't have to study that 550-page monstrosity. You don't. The reason is because the scholars in the books of tafsir, what they do is they assume you know rafa, nasab, and jar. They assume you know the mechanism of how the meanings are conveyed, and they assume you have some vocabulary. But they don't assume that you know the principles of balagha. Cold. I mean, you have to have some exposure, but you don't have to know it cold. Because before highlighting and illustrating the application within the verse, the scholar will generally restate the principle for you, because he's not assuming you're a master in it. You see, but he won't do that with grammar. And when you read the books of tafsir, this is when you get the appreciation and you're able to see the rhetorical devices, and you'll get what the pre-Islamic Arab got, and then eventually you'll be able to do it even when you're reciting on your own. Okay? So that's pretty much it. Those are the four stages of growth. And inshallah, in the next two videos, the third one and the fourth one, we're going to develop for you the past tense table. And it's a 30-minute presentation. I've already recorded it. And basically, by the end of that presentation, you will have memorized the entire table just by watching. Okay? And then we have two core issues that we'll speak about in the fourth video, which is the lack of is issue. There's no is in Arabic. And also the sequence not determining grammar issue, which I've highlighted somewhat already with the Zayd Hid Amr example. And then we'll tell you about the 15 of the 22 places, the 15 roles that an ism can play within a sentence. Because remember, the ism is very broad. Not only does it include noun, but it also includes nouns. It also includes pronouns, adjectives, and adverbs. So how do you distinguish between them? Okay, and sequence is not determining for us. How do we do it? Okay, so we'll speak more about that, inshallah, in the fourth presentation. And with all of that said, I'd like to now direct you to the comments below this video. Go ahead and leave behind a comment. Tell me what you got from this video, and inshallah, I'll see you again in a couple of days. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. So now that we're done with the four stages of growth video, and you've also read the report, and so now you can see how